about this conference as an opportunity for me to run an experiment, which is, if you look at the schedule, it's unusually, I would say, sparse. There's a low density of talks, and that's what I have dreamt of for many years, to have a conference like that. The idea would be naturally that you have plenty of time to respond to each talk, maybe take up threads here and there informally between yourselves, develop ideally new collaborations or ideas for that. So it's meant to be informal, relaxing, but it's up to you. Having said that, I also like to thank people at PI for making this event possible. We met Tyler, who has been communicating with yourselves, and he is the person to get in touch with if you have further questions. I guess he would usually be in the office on the second level, the first upstairs level. I never know the counting in different countries. It's sort of on the opposite side of the hall. You'll find your way eventually. That's Tyler. You may have met or will meet Kate Gillespie, who is the official administrator for conference organization and so on. So these are the people who may help in case of practical problems. Be aware that this is not just an illegible name tag as usual, but there's a barcode on which you may be able to use for lunch. Scan your lunch fee, whatever. Lunches are offered in the bistro, which you all have met, and that's also the place for coffee break, so you'll just most of the time stay around here nearby. Well, other than that, yeah, it's an informal event. There will be no formal conference dinner, although there is opportunity tomorrow or Wednesday evening to have dinner here. I'm told that today there is an event which prevents them from serving us with dinners here, so you're free to find any of the nearby restaurants which are on Yeah, I guess that's it for now. Whatever comes to my mind, I've gotten up to tell you later. Let's get going, John, please. Oh, I should introduce our first session chairman, Lucien.
It's my job to introduce John. So our first speaker is John. He's a local guy. And John Barrett is going to speak on his quantum theory special, distribution, computation, and box roll process.
Yeah. Is there a pointer? And where's the hockey stick? Right. After submitting my title and abstract, I realized at some point that it was much too ambitious and I would never get through that amount of stuff. So my title is now shorter. I'm not going to talk about Boxwell. Let me begin just by reiterating anyway a few of the remarks of my abstract. There are, of course, lots of differences between quantum theory and classical theory. Which of these differences a particular physicist would mention will probably depend in general on what field they come from. But for example, a quantum information theorist might point to entanglement, non-locality, contextuality, the no-cloning and no-broadcasting theorems, and perhaps the possibility of achieving certain tasks in quantum theory, such as distributing a secret key, or presuming that this one really is impossible, classically factorizing a number in polynomial time. Now, naturally enough, these tend to be regarded as uniquely quantum features of the world. But are they? Given some kind of space of possible theories in which quantum theory sits. Which of these features are unique to quantum theory, and which ones are actually more generic? For example, is it the case that a number can be factorized in polynomial time in almost any theory, and it's just that classical theory is kind of hopeless for some reason? Or is quantum theory the only theory that can do that? Well, to elevate this beyond the level of pub talk, what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe an operational formalism for writing down essentially arbitrary probabilistic models in which classical theory and quantum theory are special cases. And then we can begin to examine different possibilities and compare and contrast. After that I'm going to mention a theorem about measurement disturbance, which in a nutshell says that measurements disturb the system in any theory except the classical theory, where they don't have to. And then I'm going to, as an example of what you can do, I'll show how that theorem suggests that the possibility of secure key distribution is there in any theory except the classical theory. And then after that, hopefully, there'll be time for me to say some words about computation. I should just say some of this, at least, is joint work with some other people, Howard Barnum, Matthew Liefer, and Alex Wills. And actually, Matt's talk is coming up next, and he's going to talk about some related things in the same framework. Okay, I'm going to begin by talking about classical systems for a few minutes. Consider an experiment like this. Suppose that we prepare a classical system, and just for the sake of definiteness, I'm going to suppose this thing can exist in one of three distinguishable states, or three different configurations, which we'll just label top, middle, and bottom. Then we're going to measure it. Well, the most obvious measurement you can do is just to look at the thing and find out whether it's top, middle, or bottom. But in general, I call a measurement any kind of interaction with the system, which can result in one from a discrete number of possible outcomes, which here I've labeled E1 to EN. Then we can write down the probability of getting the outcome EI, given that the thing was in its top state, middle state, or bottom state. More generally, suppose we don't know whether the system is top, middle, or bottom. So what we do is we assign a probability to each of those. So in this case, what I'll call a state for now, omega, is a probability distribution over the set top, middle, and bottom. And it can usefully be written as a column vector with the probabilities as entries, pqr there. And the set of all possible states I'll call big omega, which is then a triangle. It is convex. Okay, so now consider the experiment again, and suppose that after the preparation, the best we can say about the system is to describe it by this state omega, and then the measurement's done. What's the probability of outcome EI now? Well, clearly, the probability of EI given omega is just probability of EI given that it was in the top state, times probability that it was in the top state, which is P. Plus prop given middle times Q, bottom and R. Now, we can regard the outcome EI as corresponding to a map that assigns a probability to each state, probability of getting that outcome. And this means that this map is actually an affine functional from the state space omega into the interval north 1. Any such functional I will call an effect. And the measurement as a whole then corresponds to a set of these effects this first one is true by definition, but also they should sum to 1 for any state. Probability should sum to 1. And the unit effect U is defined so that U of omega is 1 on all states. So U just corresponds to an outcome that's certain to occur no matter how you prepared the thing. fine. What if we're interested in the state after measurement, as well as in the probabilities of the different outcomes? Well, in general, we can write omega I for the state after the measurement, conditioned on getting particular outcome EI. Omega I, of course, will depend on the initial state omega, but also on how we actually did that measurement. So in this regard, it's useful to introduce unnormalized states. So an unnormalized state now can be, again, written as a three-component vector. It's just that now p, q, r are kind of a greater than or equal to zero, but don't necessarily sum to one. A set of all such is a convex cone, which I denote omega plus. There's the cone. The normalized states for which p, q, r do sum to one are these ones here. There's the triangle, the three pure states. Fine. Now, the idea is that now we can associate each outcome of the measurement, EI, with a map, TI, that takes this cone into the cone. And the map's defined so that if omega is the normalized state for the measurement, then TI of omega is equal to omega I, where that's the normalized state after measurement, conditioned on outcome I, multiplied by the probability of getting that outcome, EI of omega. Now, just from thinking about mixtures, it's not too hard to argue that this map should be affine. And then if we also impose that map acting on the zero state should be zero, then it's linear. I'll call such a TI a transformation. Again, obviously, a measurement corresponds to a set of these transformations. Okay, easy joint system. Sometimes we might have two of these things, both of which can be top, middle, or bottom. A joint state is just a set of joint probabilities. There can be correlation, but not entanglement. Of course, my only reason for picking a system which could have three states is that I could draw a nice cone in three dimensions, really. We can consider systems with n distinct configurations. If n is 2, then the omega is a line, 3 a triangle, 4 a tetrahedron. For any n, this state space is a simplex. Hopefully that was all quite easy. Now I want to talk about quantum systems. This will be a bit quicker. So consider...
Questions?
Why not? I might change my mind if time is pushing, but for now.
Very quick. Was that supposed to be sort of constructing classical probability theory or constructing a generalization of it?
How much does the phrase classical probability theory contain exactly? I suppose I was constructing a little more than that.
Okay.
I mean, what you could call it, stochastic processes, maybe. A classical probability theory, but that's that. Something like that. Okay. Really, I was constructing a thing which is a classical analog, the quantum thing I'm talking about now. So the same experiment, again, I'm using all the same labels. So omega is the state before measurement, outcomes EI, unnormalized state after measurement given by TI of omega. It's just that now the set of states big omega is not a simplex. It's the set of density operators on a Hilbert space H. It's still a convex set, just a different one. EI of omega is an affine functional, again, from this set into the interval 0, 1. And any such functional can be written as the trace of EI of omega with EI a positive operator. What I'm calling a measurement corresponds to a discrete positive operator value measurement here. The unnormalized states omega plus are the positive operators. TI of omega in Krauss representation looks like this. which is to say that Ti is a linear trace on an increasing completely positive map. We know how to do joint resistance, omega density operator on the tensor product space. Fine. What do you think? That is all I'm going to say for just now about quantum theory, because what I want to do now is generalize again. General systems. The same experiment again, with all the same labels again. It's just that now this set of states, big omega, I'm not going to assume that it's a simplex necessarily. And I'm not going to assume that it's the density operators on the Hilbert space necessarily. I'm just going to allow it to be any convex set, which I will assume is finite dimensional closed. Finite dimensionality, I'll assume throughout. Closed is just so that it has extreme points, which are pure states. EI is still an affine functional from the states into the interval 0-1. I'll still call it an effect. The measurement corresponds to a set of these effects summing to 1 on all states. Unit effect is 1 on all states. Okay. It is still useful to talk about the state after measurement, and to do that using unnormalized states. So I want to define a cone omega plus on normalized states. But I want to do this just starting off from omega, the convex set. This is a slight fiddle, but I'll work through it anyway. Slight fiddle if you want to do it properly anyway. So how do we define the cone omega plus? First of all, let me write A of omega for the set of all affine maps from state space omega into the reals. So remember that an effect corresponding to a measurement outcome is a map from omega to the interval 0-1. Well, this is all maps into the reals. So obviously the effects are a subset of A of omega. A of omega is a vector space. It's obvious how to multiply one of these maps by a constant or how to add two of them. Now, here's the thing. Up till now, I've been regarding measurement outcomes or effects as maps from the states into probabilities. You can take the other point of view and turn it around and regard the state omega as a map from the effects into probabilities. Or more generally, you can think of omega as a linear map from this vector space A of omega into the reals. Informally, just write omega of A instead of A of omega, where A is an arbitrary element of this set big A. Now, the set of all linear maps from A into the reals, I'll call V of omega. Again, V of omega is a vector space, actually it's the dual space A of omega. And now, with this new way of looking at states, we can view big omega as a subset of the vector space B. And now I can define omega plus. It's the cone in B of omega, which is generated by omega. Okay. Like I said, a slight fiddle. But the place where we've ended up is pretty simple. We've just got this finite dimensional real vector space B, which states live in, and the states are a convex subset of V. Omega may generate this cone now of unnormalized states, omega plus. And there's a sort of fairly arbitrary looking example. From here on, we can continue to write omega of E instead of E of omega, where E is an effect. The norm of a state omega in this cone is given by omega of U, where U, remember, is the unit effect. A Ti now, that's the map that's associated with a given measurement outcome, is a norm non-increasing linear map from the cone into the cone. Not all Ti need correspond to physical transformations. For example, in quantum theory, only the completely positive maps correspond to physical transformations and not all positive maps. Okay, there's one more thing left to talk about in introducing this general sort of formalism, and that's joint systems. It's a little bit more involved than joint systems in the classical or the quantum case. So consider now that we've got two systems, A and B. We want to talk about the joint system AB. What we will have is some convex set of states A, which is omega A, and similarly for B, and also a convex set omega AB, which is the set of joint states. And these all live in corresponding vector spaces. But nothing I have said up till now tells us how all these things are actually related. So we need to say a bit about that. Well, let's suppose that given that these are supposed to be separate systems, suppose that given some measurement on system A and some measurement on system B, suppose we can do those measurements at the same time. And suppose at the least that a joint state ought to assign probabilities to all the possible joint outcomes when I do these measurements. In fact, let's go further. Let's define the joint state, omega AB, as a map that assigns probabilities to outcome pairs EF, where E is an effect on the A system, and F an effect on the B system. Now what we're going to do is, I'm not going to say anything that fixes the set omega AB uniquely, but I'm going to define two extreme possibilities, which are called the maximal tensor product of omega A and omega B, and the minimal tensor product of omega A and omega B. And the assumption will be that the set of joint states, omega AB, is somewhere in between these two. So first of all, the maximal tensor product, which is omega A tensor max omega B. Formally speaking, this is the set of all bilinear maps from the Cartesian product of A of omega A and A of omega B into the reals. Remember that this A of omega A is the vector space which the effects on the A system live in, and similarly this one for omega B. And the map should satisfy, when it's evaluated on a pair of effects, E and F, that's when it's supposed to be a probability, so it should be between 0 and 1. And furthermore, it should be normalized. Omega AB on UA UB should be 1, where those are the unit effects in the A and B systems. Okay. Another definition. A direct product state is a state in this set, this maximal tensor product, and it's one which satisfies this omega A cross omega B on the pair EF is just probability omega A gives to E times the probability omega B gives to F, and so that's what you think a direct product state is, no correlation. And then finally another definition, the minimal tensor product. This is a subset of the maximal tensor product, and it's just the convex hull of all those direct product states. So it's just the separable states, essentially. It's the direct product states and all the classical mixtures thereof. Good. Okay, yes, as I said, we assume that the space of joint states, omega AB, is contained somewhere in between these two possibilities. Just a few remarks about this. The vector space in which this set of joint states lives can be thought of as the tensor product of the vector spaces G and I get A and omega B living. Now, for any state in the maximal tensor product, these marginals do not depend on which measurement was done on the A system and vice versa. So the no signaling principle is satisfied. But obviously that's one of the things that motivates that definition. A joint state, omega AB, from the maximal tensor product is completely determined by the joint outcome probabilities of all the local measurements. Trivially from the definition. But I want to emphasize that assumption does actually have content. It's not something that should obviously be true in all theories. It is true in the classical theory. It is true in quantum theory. It's not true in, say, quantum theory defined over a real Hilbert space instead of a complex Hilbert space. Okay. Nonetheless, it is obviously true in all the theories I talk about here. In case this is helpful and it's not obvious already, that omega A, the maximal tensor product of these two, is intuitively the set of all non-signaling states that you can actually write down, whereas the minimal tensor product is just all the separable states. So any state that's in this one but not in this one is entangled. If either of those two subsystems is a classical system, then these two tensor products coincide. So you can't write down any entangled states in particular. And finally, in quantum theory, omega AB is actually strictly larger than the minimal tensor product. Well, that's quite obvious, as there are entangled states in quantum theory. It's also strictly smaller than the maximal tensor product. Maybe it would help if I just tried to indicate that with a couple of remarks. How should I say this? Suppose that Alice and Bob start off sharing a singular state. Suppose that an operation is performed at Bob's end only, which is the operation known as the universal knot operation. It's the one that sends spin up z to spin down z, and spin up x to spin down x, and spin up y to spin down y. It's not an operation you can actually do physically, because it's not completely positive. But mathematically, you can do it. So what does it do to the singlet state? Well, it turns the density operator into an operator which is not quantum because it's not positive. It has a negative eigenvalue. But it is positive on all pairs of local measurements. So as long as you only do local measurements, it returns sensible probabilities. And of course, it's non-signaling. So that is an example of a state which is in this maximal tensor product thing. It won't return a sensible probability if you try to do a Bell-basis measurement on it. That's where the negative eigenvalue is. It's not a bad quantum state.
So you're saying that the final module is completely positive, are you distinguishing them?
The quantum ones.
Well, the physical ones.
Well, completely positive, I understand as being a word that applies to transformations. Mm-hmm. So whereas now I'm talking about states, so I'm not sure what completely positive states would be exactly. But the quantum ones are easily defined, of course. They're just the density operators on the tensor product Hilbert space.
Can you please recall the definition of this maximal?
Maximal one?
Yes.
The idea is to define these states as maps that assign probabilities to pairs of outcomes. E is an outcome for A and F for B. And so the maximal tensor product is a set of all bilinear maps from this, the Cartesian product of these vector spaces. And these are the vector spaces the effects live in.
They may be negative for joint effects. Right? This is the point. The ones that are not quantum are those that are negative for joint effects, not for broken effects. A and F are effective, right?
The all states in the maximal tensor product are positive on pairs of local effects. Okay.
So if they are negative for joint effects, then they are not one.
Right. That's it. Okay, that is pretty much it for introducing this this formalism. I should probably pause at this point with a couple of remarks. First of all, there's nothing very novel about it. I mean, people have sort of played with generalized formalisms of this kind for years. Going back to, say, Mackey in the 1950s and lots of others. I've probably done a lot of people a great disservice by not citing them at sort of each point where I introduced something. The trouble is I don't actually know the history of this very well. Alex Wills says that the maximal and minimal tensor products were introduced by Namioka and Phelps at some point. Okay, and in addition, the question of what is special about quantum theory in this setting is not very new either. One of the things that all these people have been doing is trying to derive quantum theory from sets of axioms and applied in this framework or in things like it. So what is more recent then is the input of quantum information theory. Quantum information theory suggests that we can investigate information processing in the different models that you can write down in this framework. This may suggest new sets of axioms, newer approaches, a new way of looking at things. At the very least, I think it suggests new questions that can be asked and then addressed. Okay. Now I'd like to proceed and actually give you a result. And this is that theorem about measurement disturbance that I mentioned at the beginning. This is what the next few slides will be about. As I said, in a nutshell, the theorem is that measurements disturb the system, unless the system is classical, in which case they don't have to. First, I need a couple of definitions. A state cone omega plus is reducible if it can be written as omega 1 plus, if it can be written as the direct sum of two other cones, omega 1 plus, omega 2 plus. What do I mean by the direct sum of two cones? This means, first of all, that the vector space which omega plus lives in can be written as a direct sum of vector spaces V1 and V2. And also, the cone omega 1 plus lives entirely in V1, and omega 2 plus lives entirely in V2. And furthermore, any element omega of this cone omega plus can be written omega equals omega 1 plus omega 2, where omega 1 is a state from the first cone there, and omega 2 is a state from the second cone there. If a cone is not reducible, then it's irreducible.
This is a uniquely written, right?
Would such a decomposition be unique? I should think so. Except that it may be that these things are themselves reducible and can be further decomposed.
No, but as an element of omega 1 and omega 2 is unique, right?
Oh no, don't
it's that. Like the usual that some of it.
This need not be unique. Should need it? I might have to think
about that. It's some vector space, right?
It's a definition, so it's a
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't actually matter. I'm just going to say if it can be written in this form, then reducibility. I always get these things wrong when I try and do them on my feet. I'll think about uniqueness later. Okay, so much for the mathematical definition of reducibility. It might be helpful to say what this means in terms of the state space, omega. Reducibility of the cone omega plus implies that we can find two disjoint subsets of omega, omega 1 and omega 2 there, such that any state in omega is either a state from the omega 1 subset, or it's a state from the omega 2 subset, or it's a classical mixture of states from omega 1 and omega 2. So this is essentially a generalization of the idea of the superselection rule in quantum theory. Think of these omega 1 and omega 2 as different sectors, and any state is either in one of those sectors or the other, or is a classical mixture. Okay, another definition. A measurement which corresponds to the set of transformations Ti, remember one Ti per outcome, is non-disturbing if and only if Ti acting on omega, summed over I, is equal to omega for all omega in the state space. So this means that if you perform a measurement and say you don't look at the outcome, or you forget the outcome, or someone else did it and they didn't tell you the outcome, then you will describe the state after the measurement just by averaging over the different states conditioned on each outcome. What this is saying is that when you do that, state after measurement is the same as the state before measurement. In that case, we say that the measurement is non-disturbing. And here's the theorem. Given a state cone omega plus, write it in this form as a direct sum of subcones, where each omega I in this sum is itself irreducible. And now suppose that the set Ti corresponding to some measurement is non-disturbing. Then it follows that each Ti is of this form. It's a direct sum of terms where each term is proportional to the identity, where that's the identity acting on the vector space which the cone omega j lives in. Okay. Again, that's the mathematical statement. What does this mean? It means, for example, that if we're given an unknown pure state omega, from that state cone omega plus, we can determine with certainty which of those irreducible subcones omega lives in without disturbing the system at all. So the question of which sector is the state in corresponds to classical information that can be extracted without any disturbance from the system. On the other hand, once we know that the pure state omega is in a particular one of these irreducible subcones, is in one of these sectors, then a non-disturbing measurement won't tell you anything more about omega.
Sir?
Yeah?
When did you establish a connection between measurements and their effect? Because why couldn't you just do a measurement that gives you information without disturbing this data?
I assumed that a measurement, that each outcome of a measurement corresponded to a linear map Ti, where that's a map from our cone of unnormalized states into itself. And Ti,
so maybe what I'm asking is what's the key element that goes into proving that?
Yes, well, I'm not going to go through the proof. But the key element is a bit of linear algebra. That's not all that difficult. You define... The thing is, if the cone is d-dimensional, then you can find d linearly independent pure states. Now, if it's irreducible, it's got to have more pure states than that. So there are some more pure states again, which can be written as linear combinations of that first set of pure states.
Right.
And the action of any linear map on that new pure state is determined by what it did to the old ones. So if you try to make it non-disturbing on all of them, it's sort of not trivial that you can do that. And in the end, you can't do it unless the map is just a constant times the identity. That's how the proof proceeds. I don't know how it works. Yeah.
Why pure? Why doesn't this hold for non-pure states?
Given an unknown...
That's not bad.
You're right. I it could be mixed.
It's just, okay.
Okay, this result about measurement disturbance suggests that you can do secure key distribution in any non-classical theory. So to demonstrate that, what I want to show you now is a key distribution protocol. It's along the lines of the what are called the prepare and measure protocols in quantum theory, where Alice prepares a system in one from some number of different states and sends it to Bob, and then Bob measures it. And the reason these things are secure is because if Eve has a look at this state as it comes along to try and find out which it was, then she will disturb it. So we're going to construct a protocol which works along the same lines. So first of all, assume a d-dimensional irreducible state code. There's no such thing if in a classical theory, because classical state codes are always reducible. But in any non-classical theory, we don't use generality here, because even if you have a reducible state code, there must be at least some bit of it, some sector that is itself irreducible, and we can focus attention on that. Here's a little lemma that we need. It's just a slight strengthening, actually, of that disturbance result. Given D linearly independent pure states, but from our irreducible cone omega plus, any measurement either disturbs at least one of those, or it gives no information. Okay, and now here's the protocol. First of all, Alice is going to prepare K key systems, what I call key systems. And each of them is either in a state omega 1 or in the state omega 2 at random. Alice also prepares N, what I'll call test systems. And those are in a random state drawn from the whole set, omega 1 to omega D. Alice sends all of these N plus K systems to Bob in a random order. In a random order because it's important that Eve doesn't know as they come by which ones are test systems and which ones are key systems. After Bob has received all of them, Alice announces over an ordinary classical public channel which ones were key systems and which ones were test systems. Now, on the test systems, Bob performs a measurement corresponding to effects E1 to ED, where the important thing is that these E1 to ED are all linearly independent. That means that this is an informationally complete measurement. And the point about an informationally complete measurement is that if you know the probabilities of all D of these outcomes, and that is sufficient to specify the state. And the reason why Bob is doing an informationally complete measurement is that yes, I do apologize, I missed something here. As well as Alice announcing which are the test systems, for the test systems she should announce which actual states they were. So which were omega 1, which were omega 5, and so on. Now Bob knows which states all the test systems were. He's done this informationally complete measurement on all of them. So he can check, I mean, he can look at all the ones which were, say, omega 5, and he can look at the statistics that he obtained from doing this measurement on each one, and he can check that he's getting the appropriate relative frequencies for each outcome. If he's not, then the system has been disturbed. And Alice and Bob abort the protocol. Okay, assuming that there's no disturbance and the protocol hasn't been aborted, Bob performs a different sort of measurement on the key systems. This time he performs a measurement with three outcomes, E1, E2, and fail. And the point about this measurement is that the probability of getting outcome E1 when the state is omega 2 is 0, whereas the probability of getting E1 when the state of omega 1 is strictly greater than 0. Similarly, the probability of getting E2 on omega 1 is 0, but E2 on omega 2 is strictly greater than 0. And this is what we call a conclusive discrimination measurement. And the point is that if you have a system and you know that it's either omega 1 or 2, but you don't know which, you can do this measurement. And you'll either find out that it was definitely omega 1, or that it was definitely omega 2, or you'll get failed, which just means I don't know. One has to prove that this measurement does actually exist, but by the way, given any kind of system, any reducible cone omega plus, you can do that, it does. Okay, Bob now announces over the public channel for which key systems he got this fail outcome. Those are useless, they're discarded. And for the rest, he knows for each one whether it was omega 1 or 2, and so does Alice because she sent it. And so with those, we generate a key. Omega 1 is corresponds to a bit 0, and omega 2 to 1.
The omegas could just be a basis, and you can measure a basis without disturbing it.
D is D squared. It's the dimension.
Ah, yes, D is the dimension of the, what is the state cone here, which in quantum theory is the dimension of the real Hilbert space, which are initial operators.
So in quantum mechanics, you can do key distribution with just two non-orthogonal states, right?
That's right.
And start with that. Is there any reason to believe that such a protocol couldn't always be generated here?
Yes, there is a reason. I have a specific theory in which any such protocol, if you only use two states, then it can be broken. And the reason is, for any pair of states, you can find a measurement, which, although it is disturbing by the theorem, it doesn't disturb either of those two.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in quantum theory, if you pick two non-orthogonal states, then you're going to disturb one of them. So that's why, I had to do this funny business of key systems and test systems with the tests you want from the whole set. I should come clean. I haven't sort of sat down and proven security for this thing under the most general kind of attacks with a finite number of systems with all the epsilons and deltas in place.
You can prove on a very general basis that this conclusive discrimination measurement exists just probabilistically.
Yeah, you can always find a set of effects which have these properties.
Bi-orthogonal kind of bi-orthogonal.
What's bi-orthogonal?
Say, no. E1 omega 2 0, E2 omega 1 0.
Right, yes.
You can always find, right?
Yeah.
When omega 1 and omega 2 are linearly independent. It's general.
Yeah. as I was saying, I haven't sat down and done the proof in general with the epsilons or deltas. What is clear is that if you write down a fairly weak definition of security, then this is provably secure. If you write down the sort of strongest notion of security you can, then I conjecture it's provably secure, but but it's not proven.
But it's only polynomially secure, right? Because nothing tracks it.
No, I mean, I haven't built into it anything like that that would, I mean, I'm not even thinking about efficiency right now. It's just a sort of proof of principle, really. This is relevant to, Gilles Brassard has conjectured on a number of occasions that quantum theory can actually be derived from the possibility of secure key distribution and the impossibility of secure bit commitment. I mean, this is relevant to that, because it looks like you can do secure key distribution in almost any theory. It certainly casts doubt on that conjecture. I have no idea which of these theories you can do bit commitment in. And in any case, the axiom of secure key distribution is never going to do much work for you apart from ruling out the classical case. And you could choose plenty of other axioms that would rule out the classical case. Okay, that is that. I'm going to finish off just by talking for a few minutes about computation. We can define a natural circuit model of computation for any of the models that you can write down in this general framework. So this is an example of a circuit. First of all, we have an input, which is a classical string of bits. In this case, it's 4 bits long. Then we prepare some number of different systems. Here it's 7, all in a direct product state. What we have in this particular example is that the first 4 are each prepared in states corresponding to the input. So the first bit is 0, so this is state omega 0. Second bit is 1, so this is omega 1. So on. The rest here are just prepared in some standard state of omega. They're not to do with the input, they just serve a sort of role of extra workspace that the circuit might want. Then we act on these things with gates, where a gate corresponds to some transformation that is allowed in the theory. And let me say norm-preserving transformation. So these are deterministic gates. You act on these things with a number of gates, and finally you measure one of them with a 2-output measurement. Depending on which output you've got, you output either a 0 or a 1. The crucial thing here is that it is actually well-defined to say that a particular transformation acts on 2 systems alone and isn't, say, a transformation over all the systems at once. And the thing that ensures that is that those notions of tensor products, the min and the max that I introduced, have a lot to do with the no-signaling principle in fact. Okay, we define the size of a circuit as the number of gates in the circuit. And a circuit family is then a sequence of circuits, C1, C2, and so on, where Cn is an n-input circuit. But this one here is a 4-input circuit. I mean the number of inputs which actually correspond to bits from the classical input. Okay, so how do we compute something? Consider a function f from finite bit strings into either 0 or 1. Say that a circuit family computes f if the circuit Cn from that family acting on any input x of length n, where x is a bit string, outputs f of x with probability at least 2/3. And so we don't demand that the circuit output the right answer with certainty. Demand probability at least 2/3. Just simply by doing it again and again a few times, you can make that probability as close to 1 as you want. And when should we say that some function can be evaluated efficiently in a given theory? will say that F can be evaluated efficiently if there exists a circuit family that computes F and also satisfies some conditions. The main condition is that the size of the circuit Cn from that family should be less than or equal to n to the k, some fixed k. So size is polynomially bounded. In addition to that, we have to impose some additional technical conditions to get a sensible definition. For example, uniformity is a condition that it ought to be possible for a classical Turing machine to output a description of the nth circuit in the family in polynomial time. But this is because otherwise you can sort of cheat. You can hide the answers to hard problems just in the actual design of the nth circuit. And then we don't capture a good notion of efficient computation. There are a few other technical conditions that are similar in nature. You put them there to prevent cheating, essentially. Okay, this is my last slide. Here are a couple of theorems, quite easy actually. First of all, suppose that some function f can be computed efficiently in some theory, some model that can be written down in this framework. Then it follows that f is in P space. I should probably say what that is. P space is a classical complexity class. It's those functions which can be, well, roughly speaking, it's those that can be evaluated by a classical computer using only polynomial memory requirements. So it's allowed that it can take an exponential amount of time, but it must only use polynomial memory. Now this is a large class classically. As usual with these things, it's not actually proven to be any bigger than the class P, but it's generally strongly believed to be. So this is a large class that contains some hard problems. But I quite like this result anyway, because at least it does impose some kind of upper bound on how good any of these theories can be at computation. None of them is so powerful that it can efficiently compute functions which are so hard that they're not even in B-space. Which is something, given that we didn't actually put any assumptions into the framework, really I would say that our result is coming from the no-signaling theorem. Okay, here's another theorem. Consider some theory in which systems always combine by the minimal tensor product. In that case, any f that can be computed efficiently in that theory can also be computed efficiently classically, i.e. it's in the class P. That's not altogether surprising. Systems always combine by the minimal tensor product and there's no entanglement. So it's quite easy to simulate computation classically. You can think of this as a generalization of a quantum result, which says that if a state ever gets entangled throughout a quantum computation, then you can simulate that computation efficiently, classically.
Are you keeping the dimension fixed here?
Yeah, all that sort of thing goes into those few extra unspecified technical constraints, which I sort of shamefully glossed over. Let's see what would we want as a... Let's have all of these systems, the same type of system with the same state kernel in every circuit in the family. Let's say that a family should only be made out of some fixed finite number of different possible gates, so that you don't get just sort of arbitrarily big gates happening later down. I don't know. That the gates themselves shouldn't sort of have hard to compute things hidden in the abilities. There's a few conditions like that, but I think they're reasonable, and it's the same anyway in classical and quantum cases. I finish off with a sort of crazy hypothesis. to just affirm, suppose some function f can be computed efficiently in some theory, then the hypothesis is that it can also be computed efficiently by a quantum computer. In other words, quantum theory is the best for computation out of this whole space of possibilities. It would be very kind of nature to give us the best one. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Well, we have plenty of time for discussion, so I want to think of your questions. So, Dan was first possible.
Yeah, maybe I can ask you to elaborate on this hypothesis. I mean, you've tried different theories and haven't been able to come up with something that does.
I mean, potentially that's the kind of thing which is very hard to prove. When you know how it goes in complexity theory, we don't even know if P is NP or not.
Sure, but you could.
I have thought about computation in specific models which are non-quantum and non-classical. I don't know. I didn't get a definite result, but I sort of gained some insight which motivated this hypothesis. The model I was looking at was one in which you use it's designed so that systems are always combined by the maximal tensor product, and so that any non-signaling correlations can be obtained in this model. So it was designed to include these correlations that people talk about in the literature, the stronger than quantum correlations, people have called PR boxes and so on. The point of this model is that these correlations are now contained in an actual theory with dynamics, measurements, and so forth. So you can investigate things like computation. And what happens is that because you've got so many states, this theory is very permissive with respect to states. It allows any non-signaling correlations. The dynamics is very restricted. The dynamics has to be a linear map that takes states to states. And it's restricted for the simple reason that when an allowed transformation acts on something that's an allowed state, it had better take it to something else which is also an allowed state. When you sort of work that through, the dynamics becomes very restricted. And it looks as if that particular theory is actually no better than classical computation. At least that's my conjecture. Not proven. So, I mean, the intuition that I would say I gained from that, which is to some extent driving this hypothesis, is that quantum theory seems to achieve this very nice balance between possible states and possible dynamics, which would seem to be ideal in some way for computation.
So have you looked at other kinds of intermediate theories? Or?
Not really. The only other thing I've done is thought about theories where systems always combine via the maximal tensor product, in addition to that specific one I just mentioned, and try to show that they know better than classical. This my idea is there something to do, but no results.
There's something puzzling me about the answer you gave to Robin's question about whether there existed a key distribution protocol that could just experience. It sounded as if you were saying it was possible to do a measurement which revealed some information about which two states there were without disturbing them. But if that were the case, then you would be able to clone states. You could gain some information.
Cloning those two, yes, but it wouldn't be a universal cloning operation because those two aren't the only two in state space. You are disturbing some of the others.
So,
I can tell you the example. I think they consider a state space which is just a square. So we have four pure states. Now, if you think about the transformations and measurements you can do on that, if you just pick two of them, you can do a measurement which distinguishes those two perfectly. If you know that it's one of those two, you can distinguish them perfectly and that not disturb it. And once you've found out for certain which one it is, you can just put that one, you know. But you will disturb it. It's one of the other two. So it's not universally blaming on this square state space.
This workshop is supposed to be also a learning process for people who are not insiders but want to make improvement. So I'll ask a very stupid question. I've worked with quantum mechanics all my life, and I sort of understand what a quantum system is, and I also understand to a certain extent what a classical system is. What's an intermediate system? Physically.
Presumably there's no such thing because we live in a quantum universe. I'm investigating the toy theories, which, as far as we know, have nothing to do with nature. But the reason I'm doing that is I'm hoping to learn more about the quantum case by doing this, by setting it in a context of other possibilities. Now, if the question is what is an intermediate system in the sort of formalism which I've written down,
that's clear. I understand mathematically what it means, but I mean, is there some physical? Could physically an intermediate system exist? And one talks about semi-classical approximations, but that's something else.
Yes.
Together. So,
is this
a way to establish that quantum mechanics is the theory after all, and to eliminate all the others even from discussion?
A priori, there doesn't seem to be any reason to reject any of these other theories. The reason to reject them is because experimental evidence
is
favor of quantum theory and not the others. Now, this question, is quantum theory special in some way out of this set of possibilities? I mean, special apart from being the one that's confirmed. I don't know if that's a good question or not. If quantum theory does turn out to be optimal for computation, did we need to know that? What does that really mean in terms of the sort of who we are and the universe? I don't know, but I just find the question somewhat intriguing at the moment, so I'm exploring.
If I can make a quick response to that, I think point one is that there are theories that are clearly physical and intermediate between classical and quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics with super selection rules is quite literally intermediate. It's an operator algebra theory where the possible states are a subalgebra of the quantum states, but a superalgebra of the classical states. So that's a physical intermediate theory. But I think that the interesting theories that John is talking about, and John, correct me if I'm wrong, are not in any sense intermediate. They're sort of not convex combinations or intermediate between classical and quantum. They're off in some other direction.
They're just different. Yeah. Actually, let me follow up on my answer with one more remark, which I don't know your background. You might not be interested in. But it's an extra motivation for doing this, which comes from quantum information, and it comes from doing quantum information practically. In any practical sort of scenario in which we're trying to do something or achieve some task or process information, there are always technological sorts of limitations. So in theory, you might suppose that, you know, the set of states is all density matrices, and the set of measurements is all these, you know, problem measurements and so forth. In practice, it'll only turn out that probably there are only a few of these different ones that you can actually do. It might be that you only want to assume very weak things about an eavesdropper, which allows her to do extra things. So in that case, it might actually be useful to describe this scenario using some sort of convex set-type formalism I've described, which isn't actually the full standard quantum formalism, but rather corresponds to the things you can do technologically and the assumptions that you want to make about other people in this given scenario.
In other words, it's sort of an approximation to quantum theory, and you're interested in finding out how much of an approximation you can do and still get the correct information out of it.
Sure, that's the same as what I was trying to say. But maybe, I mean, maybe. Maybe I can say more later if you like.
Sure. I'm trying to understand these states that aren't mentally operators. That means they're not additive, or what? I mean, like, we consider ourselves.
You mean?
Additive and mentally operators.
You mean the ones in quantum theory? No, sorry. You mean the ones which I said were in the maximal tensor product?
Yeah.
But aren't in quantum theory.
They can't be additive, right, if they're not tensor.
They are operators on the tensor product Hilbert space. So if the systems are A and B, and if they have Hilbert spaces HA and HB, then one of these states on the maximal tensor product would correspond to an operator on the tensor product HA tensor HB. It's just that that operator would not be a positive operator acting on the tensor product.
So
that's why it's not a quantum state.
It's positive on the effects, but not on the whole.
It's positive on. It's a Hermitian operator. It's a linear, you know, Hermitian operator.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not positive, so it's not a density operator. But it just turns out that it is positive on a subset of all the effects. It's positive on pairs of local effects.
Uh-huh.
So if I make a joint effect of the form E tensor F, E and F are effects on the individual system, it would be positive on any effect of that form, just negative on some joint effects,
mm-hmm.
like the outcomes of the Bell-based equation.
Yeah, have you tried to determine whether a kind of graphite is in your theories? Because it looks like you could solve that from the comment you sent on key distribution. If you can distinguish 0 or 1 from a superposition, you can solve the graph.
Okay, good. I would be fascinated. No, I haven't thought about it at all.
But we don't know if it's in
Right, but it would be very interesting if it was. Well, okay, we don't know VQP, but it would be interesting if you could show you could do it in some theory.
Sounds like
one of the assumptions that goes into your model is this local tomography assumption that you can establish the state hyperconference.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in real hyperconference space quantum theory,
mm-hmm.
That isn't true. And yet, still many of the theorems that we're looking at seems to be true in that case. So do you know how much work that assumption is doing for you? How necessary it is?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, it would depend, of course, which results we're actually talking about. In, say, key distribution, what would happen would be that Alice is sending all these systems to Bob, and they're all got some, well, Alice prepares them in a great direct product state. But you see, if you drop that assumption, then this joint system has some extra degrees of freedom. Somehow you may not picked out by only doing local measurements. So you certainly have to think about Eve somehow probing those extra degrees of freedom and how that relates to disturbance.
Okay.
And I haven't thought about that, so I'm not quite sure what would happen.
And what about the theorem? Yeah, I think this there's another theorem, right? This one about. No, there's another theorem.
the P space theory.
Ah, yes. The P space theory.
You said you thought that was primarily because of the low capital, the non zero.
Yes, I did say that. So how could P space fail? It could fail maybe if you had something really kind of silly like when you have n of these systems, when the assumption fails, you get these extra degrees of freedom to do with the joint state. Now, if the number of those extra degrees of freedom somehow explodes as you get more and more systems, could that impact the space result? on my feet, I don't know.
Can I ask about the sense in which your framework could fail to be consistent? I don't think it does fail to be consistent. I'm wondering if you've checked carefully. So you assume that at your disposal you have essentially dice that you can roll. You can generate any probability distribution you like to create mixtures of states, for example. Now, you could say, well, there's sort of a classical universe that's external to the systems I'm imagining. But suppose you want to say everything obeyed this theory, and those dice must also obey this theory. There are systems within this theory. Then if you want to prove consistency, you have to show that there are enough resources to be able to build such dice, and that, for instance, there exist conditional transformations that allow you to say, measure how the dice came up and then transform a system depending on how it came up. And I'm just wondering if you've gone through and verified that you have all those resources.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure that in the general case, you won't be able to make a theory consistent in that way. The way I'm setting things up is just to assume that sort of external classical world with its own sort of dice and things which you can roll. And all this formalism that I don't know describes some sort of internal degrees of freedom these systems have. So it's a very interesting question, actually, which theories in this framework would have that kind of consistency. Now, suppose you want your measuring apparatus that we describe in the theory and to be one of the systems in the theory with its own state space. You want the interaction to be, you want the measurement to correspond to an interaction between apparatus and system. It's an allowed transformation in this theory. Which theories could you do that for? Quantum theory, of course, very nice. No, it works. I've thought about that. A bit in the case of a particular non-quantum, non-classical theory, which I was talking about a minute ago, the one that allows sort of arbitrary non-local correlations. And there I proved a result that actually you can't make the theory consistent in that way. But let me not state it quite as bluntly as that, because there were a couple of assumptions in there about what properties a transformation should have to count as a measurement transformation. I'd like to go back to that and see with what we had with how weak a set of assumptions I can prove that result. It certainly seems as if you can't make that thing consistent in this way. And another question I quite like is, even within the subset of theories which you can make consistent in that way and put the measurement device in the theory, there will still typically be a measurement problem. In the same sense, there is one in quantum theory. And so I find it quite interesting to sort of speculate about, if one of these theories were experimentally confirmed in some universe, that the inhabitants would be wrestling with this problem, what would be the options actually open to? Would they be the same range of options that we have in quantum theory or different? But not much more to say about that right now.
So one of the, out there in the great wide world, there are a number of physicists who doubt that we do live in a quantum world. They think that maybe things spontaneously collapsed, or in extreme cases they say things like, well, this quantum computing business has to be crap because surely quantum mechanics is going to break down at some point. And there are some people like Scott Aronson who are very fond of trotting out this argument that, well, all the other theories are even more computationally powerful than quantum mechanics, and so that's a good reason to keep on thinking about it. You've got to conjecture that these theories are no more powerful than quantum computing. What about how many of them, vaguely speaking, are less powerful? if it turns out that we're, you know, we don't quite have quantum mechanics, do you think we'll still have the same power?
Wants an integer.
Well, the problem is I don't know anything about the power of many of them, really.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, I don't feel too embarrassed about that, because we don't know anything about the power of classical computers, but, you know, let alone quantum. It makes these sorts of questions hard. But actually, yes, I mean, I like your first remark. Scott hasn't investigated computation in a number of alternative models, and then the result has always been that they're more powerful than quantum theory, sometimes incredibly more powerful. Now, those models don't fit into this sort of framework. He's looked at what computation, closed time-like curves, and computation in a funny kind of theory, which is a hidden variable theory, but you can actually read out the whole history of the hidden state. And computation in post-selection, you can just choose which measurement outcome you want. Other people have looked at computation in non-linear quantum theory. All these things turn out to be much more powerful. But they also turn out to be kind of sort of silly, or at least it looks silly in other ways. But for example, violating the no signaling principle, or involving closed time-like curves, or what have you. So I like this because we seem to have a whole, I mean, not just one of the entire space of theories, which are just not obviously silly, and in that set, it doesn't seem obvious, at least, that there are extremely powerful systems.
If your hypothesis were true, does that mean that you could derive finite dimensional quantum mechanics from your axioms, or follow from your axioms?
If the hypothesis were true, you mean if we adopted the hypothesis as one of our axioms?
Well, let's say you could prove this. Right?
Yes, I suppose you could prove that.
Yeah.
Well, and then you want to make it, having proved it, you want to make it an axiom, and thereby...
Well, you have various axioms that go into this hypothesis. Right, the axioms of the previous slide.
Oh, you mean?
Of the conditions of the previous slide.
Did you mean setting up the model? I mean, this and.
No, the previous slide, did you have those conditions that you need?
They won't look like that.
The local tomography and
the ones that you didn't have complete.
The one where I just wrote a few other technical.
Yeah. Now, you would use that to prove your hypothesis or something. How would you prove your hypothesis?
I wouldn't attach too much importance to this.
The thing is,
given any theory, you have to think about, well, what does it mean to compute in this theory? And what's an appropriate model that captures what I mean by saying efficient computation in this theory. And for example, if the theory is classical theory, then we write down a Turing machine for the classical circuit model, and we say these models capture what we mean by efficient.
Well, whatever you need to prove your hypothesis, then those conditions would be able to derive quantum mechanics. Is that true?
Well, if you impose these, I'm not quite sure that if you impose all those conditions, let's say, then this hypothesis, if true, would just tell you that quantum theory is the best for computation. In a sense. it wouldn't tell you that quantum mechanics is the actual theory, unless you also assume, as one of your axioms, that the actual theory is the best one for computation.
But even then, you don't get that, right? Because there could be other theories that are just as fine.
Yes, exactly. You're quite right. I mean, the hypothesis doesn't assert the uniqueness of this particular. So even then, maybe not.
So, John, as you know, your framework doesn't include, there's a broader framework than the one you've written down here, which doesn't allow all the effects that are at a positive Hamilton space, but a subset of those. And that's the kind of framework that you would want to be in if you want to talk about being variable. The question I have is, does your theorem about no information gain, that measurement disturbance, go through for theories in that broader framework?
That too. Yeah, so
it wasn't clear that you used the full fact that you had the full set of effects in the proof, but
the measurement disturbance thing should still go through. I mean, after all, I'm not ruling in any particular measurements. I'm just saying any measurement you could write down which gave you some information would disturb. You know, half the measurements actually aren't allowed. It doesn't change that fact. The ones that are allowed are still true. But yeah, just for everyone else, Rob's right in pointing out that I sort of swept something under the rug a little, which is that I was assuming at least on some occasions that when I'm, so suppose I begin with a particular state space omega, well, I can write down mathematically all of the affine functionals from omega into the interval 0,1. I was assuming sometimes that all of those functionals actually do correspond to the outcomes of physical measurements that you can actually do. For example, when I asserted the existence of certain measurements in the key distribution protocol, and what's Rob saying is that you can write down a class of models which involve a state space omega again, but where you sort of strip the possible measurements that you can do. You declare that only a proper subset of those affine functionals actually correspond to allowed measurements, and then you get some interesting new theories to look at.
Okay, I guess time for questions.